Last week we were looking at the Shaiva traditions. If you recall, the broad textual categories. The Shrutis, the Vedas, and the Upanishads, the Smriti, the supplementary texts that in theory sort of elaborate on what the Shrutis are saying, whether that's in the form of the ritual manuals for Vedic ritual or Puranas, Mahabharata, and so on. And then we looked at the Tantric text, a separate revelation that is sectarian in nature in the sense that only specific traditions accept the validity of these texts. And we saw that there's two main types we're discussing, characterized by their orientation or the focus of their worship. We have Vaishnava texts, Vaishnava Tantric texts, which are the Pancharatra texts, which inform the ritual practices of most Vaishnava traditions. We've seen Ramanuja's, the guru of Ramanuja's guru, Yamuna, wrote a text defending the validity of these against the criticisms of both Advaita Vedanta, which rejects the validity of these Tantric texts, as well as the Mimamsakas, the Vedic ritualists, that accept only the validity of these two categories. And then we saw with the Shaivas, you have the Shaiva Agamas, and we briefly then looked at the distinction between right and left of those right-hand Shaivism being dualistic, left-hand Shaivism being non-dualistic. We saw here the main tradition that bases itself on these is the Shaiva Siddhanta, a tradition that becomes very devotional once it reaches the south of India and blends with the Shaiva devotional traditions of the Tamil-speaking region with the poetry of the Nayanmars, who are Vaishnava, Shaiva saints living in the sort of the first millennium, some period. The exact dates are disputed, but are similar to the Alvars in style and so on, which are the Vaishnava Tamil poets living around the same time in the same region. So hopefully that rings a few bells and you remember some of this. Now, do recall though that one of the big differences between the Pancharatras and the Agamas, or the Shaiva Agamas, is the way the adherents of those texts view the relationship between the Tantric texts and basically everything that's there, the Shruti and the Smriti text. We've seen Yamuna, Ramanuja's guru's guru, argues that the Pancharatra texts are on equal level with the Vedic texts, and argues that the Vaishnavas are Vedic in the sense that they follow what the Vedas are saying in the form of the Upanishads, in the form of the Vedanta, and that the Pancharatra merely complements that and elaborates on teachings found in Vedanta texts and teaches a ritual practice that is different from the Vedic ritual practice, but that is complementary with it, and that merely extends the scope of the Vedic ritual tradition. And so the argument there is that the Vedic texts would be dependent on or Vedic ritual practices as taught in the Vedas and their ritual manuals that are here in this category, they're dependent on a lot of preconditions. So you have to be born a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, or a Vaishya. You have to be initiated in the study of the Veda and so on, as we've seen the Vedic ritualists argue. Whereas the Vaishnavas say, well, the Pancharatra text extend that scope for worshipping Vishnu not through Vedic rituals, but then through Pancharatra rituals, as in temple worship and some meditational practices, because Vaishnava Pancharatra initiation is open to anyone, including women, which are not, or sort of excluded from the worship, from Vedic worship. And so that's kind of the idea of the Vaishnava tantric text. The Shaivas, as we've seen, see themselves as outsiders to the Vedic tradition. And so they argue that the Shaiva Agamas are not on an equal level as the Vedic texts, but are rather higher. They teach a higher path of worship. And if you remember from that passage we briefly looked at from the Kularnava Tantra last week, where you kind of get this hierarchy of different paths that are taught, and the Veda is kind of the lowest of them all, and then higher than that is the Vaishnava way of worshipping, the Panchatra way, and then higher than that is the worship of Shaivism, higher than that is the tantric form of worship of Shaivism, higher than that is the Shaiva Siddhanta, and higher than that, this is a left-hand tantric text, is the left-hand worship of Shiva. A small caveat on that. As we've seen, Shaiva Siddhanta, as it develops, becomes in character very similar to, say, the Sri Vaishnavas who are there, the followers of Ramanuja who are there in the same region, and in sort of terms of their attitudes towards ritual, in terms of their attitudes towards the Vedic text, there's not all that much difference in a way. And so the Shaiva Siddhanta right-hand tantric traditions, as we've seen, argue that there's a dualism, not just theologically, between the individual self and the Supreme Being, between Shiva for them, but there's also a dualism in between pure and impure. And so in their worship, they will only use pure substances, they will uphold dharmic conventions, and they will argue that it is important to follow dharmic codes as they're outlined in these two texts. The difference, though, between the, and this is what I was trying to get to last week, the difference between Shaiva Siddhanta, say, and Vishishtadvaita or Sri Vaishnavism or Madhva system of Vedanta, which also builds on tantric text, is that the Shaivas will still see that in theory the Shaiva Agamas are still higher than those texts and teach a higher path, even though they will say it is important that you follow Varnashrama Dharma, for example, the codes that are outlined in Dharma Shastra, the Shaiva Siddhantins will say. But you see it also, the difference in view, in that Shaiva Siddhanta will go for their, not just their ritual practice, but also for their theology to the Agamas. This is really their source. They'll write commentaries on this. They won't, at least initially, they won't engage with the Upanishads, they won't engage with the Gita, with the Mahabharata, with the Puranas, and so on, in the same way, because they see this as the core of their text, of their tradition. Later on, they might kind of engage, so you might have some Shaivas who do engage in or with these other texts, but it's more because those other texts have become very influential because of the discourse that sort of occurs around the Shaiva traditions, that they then start engaging with it, or because in some cases there's an alignment between certain Shaiva traditions and certain Vedantic traditions, particularly Advaita Vedanta, where they align themselves with each other for various reasons, and then the two traditions kind of merge, and you have Advaitins writing on Shaiva texts, and Shaivas writing on Advaita texts, and so on. But the way it originates is that this is the main source for both theology and ritual practice, and this is the highest source for that. Now, with this as a backdrop, what I want to do now is look at a few Shaiva traditions that have a very different take on all this, that don't align themselves like Shaiva Siddhanta does so closely with the Vedic tradition, but that rather sort of break away from this, that see themselves as either transcending it or just neglecting it or ignoring it entirely and just moving on in a different direction. And these are, as you can suspect, these are predominantly ascetic traditions of people who do step outside of society, and therefore can afford not following the rules of Varnashrama Dharma that govern society. So they don't are not expected to behave as Brahmins or Kshatriyas and so on are expected to behave, or as householders and brahmacharis and so on are expected to behave, but they're ascetics who have left society behind and therefore can pretty much do whatever they want, to put it bluntly. Yeah, now, for that, I want to take a little step back first and move away from the Shaiva Tantric traditions, and we'll come back to them in a moment. But basically, if we think of Shaiva traditions, there's two main forms. And I've mentioned this briefly last week. We have the Atimarga, and this is non-Puranic Shaivism. So this is Shaivism that doesn't base itself on the Puranas. And these are initiatory traditions. So these are traditions in which you have to be initiated to practice this. And then we have the Tantric traditions. The Tantra, then we have left and right. Actually, let's put them in the way that makes sense. So left, right being Shaiva Siddhanta. Now, the traditions you have here, the Atimarga, literally the path beyond the higher path, the path of transcendence, or however you want to talk about it, is kind of a collective term for a group of traditions that have various things in common with each other, and that is a tradition that is in its oldest form. It's called the tradition of the Pashupatas. It's a tradition that kind of gets revived at various times and gets different names depending on who sort of named after the person who revived it. And so sometimes you get the most important sort of figure afterwards is a person called La Kulisha. Who's by the Atimarga is seen to be Shiva himself, who's taken possession of a deceased man, of a dead body, and then taught the Pashupata doctrine, and then kind of disappeared. For as a shorthand, we'll just talk about them as being Pashupatas, although it's a little more complicated in that the tradition kind of gets revived a couple of times, and as it's revived, gets a different name. Now, the Pashupatas are not a tantric tradition, and we'll see that their concerns are very different from the concerns of both left and right-hand tantric traditions, whether it's Shaiva or Vaishnava. But the reason why I sort of put them together with what we'll talk about about left-hand tantric traditions is because they're also they're performing practices that go against the grain of sort of regular society that are transgressive in some way. But as we'll see, the way they're transgressive is very different, or the way they see their transgression is very different from the way the left-hand tantric traditions will see their own transgressions of sort of the codes as laid out in Dharmashastra and Vedic and Smriti texts and so on. The Pashupatas are an ascetic group, and we have very little of their literature still. It's a tradition that no longer exists. We have a few of their texts that survived. And the key text is a text called the Pashupata Sutras, with a commentary on them by a person called Kaundinya. What you have in the handout is all excerpts from Kaundinya's commentary on the Pashupata Sutras. Now, you see again the terminology that's used is very different from the terminology that's used in the Vedantic traditions that we've looked at so far. So you have, again, as we saw last week with the Shaiva Siddhanta, you have the notion of Pashupati and Pasha. So Pashu, the animals, the beasts of cattle, are the individual living entities. Pati, the Lord, is Shiva, and Pasha is that which binds us. It's the noose, the rope that ties the animal to a post and so on. And so that's kind of reflected in their name. And so this is Shiva, and we have to attain Shiva somehow by removing the pasha, removing our bondage. And so it's a terminology that, as we've seen, derived from Agama texts as well, but it's broader than the Agama, than the tantric tradition, and it's used here as well. And really, the Pashupatas, they don't engage with tantric texts. They're not a tantric tradition. For them, their primary text is these Pashupata sutras, which are they see them as being revealed by Shiva himself to teach them this path. Now, the reason the Pashupatas, you know, they died out, but they remained sort of in the popular imagination of Hindus for centuries. And you find, you know, even in like 16th, 17th, 18th century texts, you find references to Pashupatas, not because they're still around, but because what they were doing was so weird in the eyes of a lot of these later authors that they're kind of constantly mocked in later texts. And sort of you find a lot of these sort of surfacing characters, Pashupata characters surfacing in literary works, in drama and so on, where you get a Pashupata that comes out on stage and is kind of made fun of for what they're doing. And the reason for that is because of their practice, at least the most visible part of their practice. And the Pashupatas, they're ascetics, they renounce society, but they see themselves as not just renouncing society as the way sannyasis do, where they're still within the realm of Varnashrama Dharma. They're still within the realm of the Dharma Shastras because the sannyasis are the fourth ashrama, the fourth stage of life. But the Pashupatas see themselves as going beyond that, as transcending that. And this is where they get their name of the Ati, of the beyond or the excessive sort of way of doing it. And it's kind of this notion of Ati, of sort of going beyond something or doing something higher, doing something more excessively, more intensely, is something that permeates the Pashupata Sutras and Kondindya's commentary on it. And they kind of talk about Ati everything, pretty much. And so you have Ati Dana and you have Ati Yagya, you know, Ati, sort of the higher giving, the higher sacrifice, and so on. And you have a passage there in the beginning of the handout. But I'll just read a little bit from it that will give you a flavor of the way they're thinking about this. And so, and sort of in the background, I mean, what they're doing here is they're really critiquing the tradition of the Shrutis and the Smritis. So the practices that are advocated there, they're saying, we don't want to do this. This is defective in some way. We want to go beyond all that. And so you have Kondinya's writing there. He says, the giving of cows, land, gold, shining metals, and other items or worthless giving. These are the sort of things that Dharma Shastra says you should give to Brahmins at the end of sacrifice and so on. And he says, why are they worthless? For they bring about the result which is not final, not absolute, and inferior. And also because we have scriptural evidence of there being the wrong path. And then that's a phrase from the Pashupata Sutra itself. Thus, the prefix Ati here is a qualification. Transcendent giving, as it's translated here, Ati Dana is the offering of oneself. Why? Because oneself is the ultimate agent of giving, and there is no need for any other gift than that. It is transcendent also because it does not lead him to the cycle of rebirth. The offering of oneself is called transcendent giving because it leads him to the presence of Rudra or Shiva, finally and absolutely, because it brings about the final non-return and because its result is unique. And so it starts with sort of a similar presupposition or a similar attitude towards Vedic ritual that we've seen in some Vedantic traditions, where it's sort of looking at the common religious practices of the, you know, that permeate society and sort of say, what's the point of this? What's the ultimate value of this? We can give in charity, which is praised throughout the Dharma Shastras as being a very, if you give in charity to the Brahmins, you accumulate a lot of piety and so on. We can perform sacrifices, we can do all these things, but what's the point of this? We will still have to be born again and again, and we will not sort of attain the realm of Shiva, we will not attain Shiva. And so better to give and to sacrifice and so on in such a way that it will lead us to Shiva and will lead us to to the freedom from rebirth and lead us to liberation. So it's a similar attitude that we've seen to general ascetic traditions, and we've seen it sort of in some ways in Advaita Vedanta, in some ways even in like Ramanuja and Madhva and so on. It's kind of a general attitude that you have. But the way this gets translated into the Pashupata tradition is that they then say, okay, we're going to perform ascetic practices, and we're going to live like ascetics, but we're not going to do it in the way that is advocated in the text that we're rejecting. And so the Pashupatas, the way they're most known in society is by the most visible stage of their practice, which is a state of practice where they say, we have to attain purity of mind in order to be able to meditate on Shiva. And meditation is ultimately what their tradition is about. You want to be able to still the mind, focus on Shiva, meditate on Shaiva mantras, on mantras that are worshipping Shiva, so that you can then attain Shiva in liberation. But their reasoning is that it's very difficult to attain that purity of mind. It's very difficult to attain that stillness. And so what they came up with was a way of accelerating this, of accelerating your detachment from this world, accelerating your the ridding of your bad karma, if you want, your sort of the things that bind you to this world, through a particular type of ascetic practice that is acting like a mad person. What they would do was they would, and this is kind of Kandinya argues this, that you have to be in society, you're an ascetic, but you go in the company of other people and you act like a mad person. And when you act like a mad person, then the people will curse you. And when they curse you, your bad karma, as it were, gets removed, gets burnt off, and or transferred. So there's sort of two views, or transferred to the person who's cursing, and which means you kind of attain a purity much faster than you could by any other normal means. And so this is what you're going to do. And just to give you a flavor of what they're advocating, you have two passages from Kandinya's commentary where he says this, halfway down the page. He says, there are said to be five types of madness caused by air, by bile, and so on. And he says, the madness arising from the combination of air, bile, and phlegm is the worst. This is the one that you should imitate most. And there's quite a lot of sort of Ayurvedic reflection in here on madness, and sort of corresponds quite closely to the way madness is talked about in Ayurvedic texts. And so they sort of studied how do mad people act, what do mad people do, what's the cause of madness, and then they say, okay, let's do this ourselves, let's act this out ourselves. And so he says, this is how one should pursue one's practice. If anyone asks him for knowledge or asks them for kindness or blessings, he should prevent that person and say, please come in. Then, once inside, if someone asks threateningly, who are you? He should be told, I am Maheshwara, I am Kartikeya, I was the son of Shiva. This man has troubled me greatly and I touched him to kill him, not to enjoy. Then he should walk away. This is how he should create confusion among people who come to test him. He should pretend to have a mind that functions like that of a madman or a ghost. And so basically you act erratically. Kandinya says you should go to a temple and you should go into the temple when people are worshipping there and you should start dancing really wildly and, you know, act totally inappropriate and shout and scream and roll on the ground and so on. And then people will think, oh, this person is mad, and they will curse you. And this is good. This is what you want. The next passage I particularly like, where again Kandinya is saying how you should act. He says, you should enter a village or a town and should stay neither very far, and it's kind of very, I like the precision in which he explains everything. So he says, he should enter a village or a town and should stay neither very far nor very close to a group of people so that they would not be put to any trouble, yet would see him. So not too close. You don't go sort of lie down or sit next to them, because then you'll inconvenience them. But don't stay too far, because then they won't notice you, and that's the whole point. You want to be seen. But you should also avoid the path of elephants, horses, chariots, and pedestrians. Otherwise, they'll trample you. Sit down and practice nodding, yawning, and so on, as if you were asleep. He should lie there pretending to sleep, though keeping awake. Then he should make a snoring sound in his throat when he exhales. The people will then recognize him to be sleeping, either mentally or verbally. Either the people will think, oh, this man is sleeping, or they'll say to each other, ah, look, that guy is sleeping there on the road. And they will insult him. By this false practice, whatever merit the people have, that will come to him, to the ascetic, and whatever demerit he has goes to them. And so this is what the Pashupatas are doing, and so you can sort of imagine why, you know, you can see why they quickly become so prominent in the popular imagination of these ascetics who start acting like crazy people, who are seen to be the whole point of this is the people should think you are actually crazy, not that you're acting like a crazy person. But it's kind of, Kaundinya goes further than that, and he says, one of the things you should do as well is you should, and this is, you know, they're all male ascetics, and so he says you should go to a young woman, an attractive young woman, and you should make very lewd comments to her, and you should pretend like you're seducing her, so that, you know, she and her family and so on will curse you. And that's particularly good, because if you do those sort of acts, people really don't like that, and so people will really think you're a mad person, and this is sort of they will curse you even further. And so you have these ascetics going around, you know, talking lewdly with young women, and pretending to be seducing them, and getting cursed by everyone. This is the big difference, as we will see, with left-hand tantric traditions. The Pashupatas are very insistent that you cannot go beyond acting. So you have to act like a mad person, and you have to act as if you're trying to seduce this young woman, but you can't actually go further than that. And to kind of remove any doubt, there's quite a few passages in their literature that are very sort of kind of making this point by saying, you know, here's how you really should think about women. So you have at the bottom there, you have a few passages from that. It says, the inclination of the mind to think of women is the rope that binds one. That's one of the main sort of pashas that binds you to this world, to this body, to rebirth. The pious cut it, but the impious do not give it up. Because of a woman, one leaves the village, and one buys and sells for the sake of women. Women are the source of everything worthless. The wise should not embrace her. She whom people regard as women is in reality poison, which consumes a man's life like fire and is as deadly as a sword or an arrow. She's horror and illusion incarnate. Fools, not the wise, revel in the body full of impurities and worms, foul-smelling and unclean. It is the ephemeral abode of urine and excretia. It is the sight of a woman, not wine, that maddens a man. Shun, therefore, women whose mere sight, even at a distance, deludes. The world is bitten by the snake whose form is woman's sexual organ, who with mouth cast downwards moves between her thighs, beyond all control, even that of scripture. These are not sort of uncommon in ascetic texts. You have quite a lot of ascetic texts written by ascetics for ascetics, in other traditions as well, that sort of basically state the same thing, that, you know, don't, you know, these are all men who are renouncing the world, and it's like, don't get close to women, stay away from women, and here's how you should think of women, to keep you to your vows. But here you kind of, it's kind of the odd contrast that you have those sort of passages typical of ascetic texts, but at the same time they're engaged in this practice of acting, you know, in the opposite manner with young women, particularly. So it's kind of, they're perceived by society to be engaging in all sorts of weird things and being really mad persons and transgressing every norm of Dharma that is laid out in the Dharma Shastras and Vedic texts and so on. But the whole point for them is that internally you remain pure. And so there's still sort of a sense in which they retain the purity of the Vedic tradition. The notion of purity and impurity and dharma and adharma is sort of internalized in some way, whereas externally it's kind of you act in the opposite manner. Now, for the Pashupatas, this is just a preliminary stage, and this is the stage that people see because you're involved in society and you're snoring alongside of the road, or you're dancing in the temple, or you're wearing faded garlands and inappropriate clothes and so on. Anyway, they have long lists of how you should behave. But once you've been cursed enough and you've been purified enough through that cursing, you then go to the next stage of your practice, and this is the real core of what you're doing as a Pashupata for them, and which is that you retire to a solitary place, you remove yourself from society. They would, they say to a small Shiva temple or something somewhere, and then you just engage in meditation there, because now your mind is has attained sort of a purity, an equanimity, and so you can sit there peacefully and meditate on Shiva, and through that meditation attain union with Shiva, and so that by the time you die, you attain liberation and you attain the abode of Shiva. Now, the Pashupatas are dualists, and they're very strongly actually influenced. The later sections of the Pashupata Sutras resemble the later sections of the Yoga Sutras very strongly. It's like the Yoga Sutras, they have a sort of an understanding of the difference between matter and the world, between matter and the self, and an attainment of what they also call, as in yogic texts, kaivalya, aloneness, aloofness from matter, from this world. The difference between yoga and the Pashupatas is that yoga doesn't say much about actually what happens in the state of Kaivalya, or what that state is like. Yoga is a theistic tradition, but it doesn't talk about God in the context of Kaivalya, whereas here they do, and they say Shiva is there in Kaivalya, and there is some sort of union with Shiva, but you become, and this is sort of similar to the early Shaiva Siddhanta, you become like a Shiva in nature. And so you attain some sort of equality with Shiva, except that Shiva remains the God and so on. And so you never become Shiva, but you retain, as we sort of talked about last week, the Shaivas in general are uncomfortable with the notion of dependence in the state of liberation, unlike the Vaishnavas, who argue that in the state of liberation there is dependence on Vishnu. The Shaivas tend to sort of say, no, there's an equality that you reach, you become a Shiva. The Pashupatas, like the Yoga Sutras, the Pashupata Sutras argue that on the path to liberation, you will attain various powers. Once you engage in meditational practice on Shiva, you will attain these various siddhis, these various magical powers. You can become really big or really small. You can obtain things from some place. You can be in multiple places at the same time and so on. But the Pashupata Sutras and Kaundinya are very emphatic, like the Yoga Sutras, that this is a distraction, that this is the final test that you get. If you become enamored by this and you kind of go like, oh, great, look at all the powers I've gained, you've ruined your chances of attaining liberation in this life. You kind of get stuck there. But this is sort of something that comes, and it's sort of the ultimate renunciation, is you have to transcend this to these powers that you gain and become detached from those things as well. The Pashupata tradition has an element of bhakti in it, and they do talk of some sort of way of devotion to Shiva, but it's not so emphasized as you find it in some of the other devotional traditions, like you get, for example, in Shaiva Siddhanta or the Vaishnava traditions that we've looked at so far. But it is there. It's just not so central as some of the others, and which kind of is, I suppose, reflected in their understanding of the state of liberation. And so it's an unusual tradition that's very visibly that's very visible because of its you know transgressory practices, acting like a mad person. But that's actually very clean in sort of a dharmashastric way, in sort of a shruti smriti way. That's actually concerned with attaining a purity of mind and attaining a transcendence of this world in ways that, you know, at least sort of ascetic traditions in following Shruti and Smriti would not find too objectionable. It's just that early stage that's unusual. Okay. Yeah. Any questions about this so far, actually, because we'll move on to the rest. Everything clear? Okay. Now, with the tantric Shaivism, we find transgressory practices as well, but they're very different from the way they're understood and even practiced by the Pashupatas. And so, if you remember, the basic presupposition of tantric texts, whether they're Vaishnava or Shaiva, or left or right, is that matter that binds us, but if used properly through ritual, can actually set us free as well, and can lead to the freedom of liberation, or the freedom of the siddhis, these mystical powers that you can obtain. And so, the tantric traditions, you know, the Pashupatas are an ascetic tradition, so their goal is to renounce the world, to transcend the world, to leave the world behind, and to not engage with matter, or engage with matter as little as possible, and to practice meditation, to come to just basically live within. That's sort of the final stage of their practices, is happening internally. Whereas the tantric traditions, the matter is not something that you have to turn away from. It is something that if you use it properly, is good. And so we've seen that with the right-hand tantric traditions as well. They have that same presupposition. And so tantric traditions are about the worship of murtis, of images that are made of the deity that is worshipped in those tantric traditions, that is consecrated through ritual, and that the murti then becomes the embodiment of the deity. It's not an image of the deity, it's not sort of a symbol for the deity, but it's the deity itself. And so, therefore, too, the body can be used in worship when the body is purified through ritual. Then the body transforms, ritually speaking, from matter to spirit. And you attain a spiritual body through ritual by which you can then approach the spiritual deity that is worshipped in the tradition. And so you often find the phrase in tantric texts that having become a god, one should worship God. And it, this is not in sort of as the phrase has sometimes been interpreted in modern times, in sort of an Advaitin way, as Shankara might, you know, have sort of seen it in some way, that you don't become God, but you become a God, meaning you become divine through ritual, you obtain a divine body, so you can then approach the divine and worship the divine. Now, the both Vaishnava and Shaiva tantric practices, both left and right, have some basic practices that are kind of similar in both, that kind of get filled in sort of sectarian ways in both, but they are essentially the same. And the way the body is transformed is that you first, through meditation, you deconstruct the body, you destroy the body in meditation, and this varies from text to text, but sometimes it's, you know, you imagine the body to be consumed by fire, And then you gradually build the body up again with mantras, so you attain a divine body, so you can then worship the Murti. It's kind of, I think, there's long descriptions on the Bhuta Shuddhi, the purification of the elements of the body in these tantric texts. A lot of scholars have spent a lot of time, spent a lot of words on those. And in practice, those rituals are really fast. You know, it's sort of, you kind of read these texts and you think, oh, this will take forever. You know, this will take like, you know, at least a good 10 minutes or something to do it. In practice, it's like, you know, less than a minute and it's over. That's the way they do it. The difference, as we've seen, between right and left is that right will still uphold the duality between pure and impure, and will say, therefore, we transform the body, we worship with matter, we use the body in our worship, but we do so in ways that does not transgress the codes of the Vedic and Dharmashastra texts and so on. And so we will only offer pure things, we will obtain. We will uphold rules of purity. We will only make vegetarian offerings. We will only live or consume things in our daily diet that are in accordance with sort of the purity rules that are found in Dharmashastras and so on. Whereas the left-hand tantric traditions don't make that distinction. And so they will argue that even the impure, or especially the impure, should be used in the practice of this. And it's important to emphasize that this doesn't mean that they get drunk every night and have big barbecues and orgies and so on. They will engage impure substances like meat and alcohol and act like sexual intercourse in ritual, but it is all very controlled and very sort of prescribed in ritual how you have to do this. Left-hand tantric texts themselves will be quick to warn that the misuse of these practices will actually lead to madness. And so if you don't engage in these practices properly, this will sort of cause your ruin. And so the center of that of left-hand tantric rituals is what's often called the five M's, the Panchamakara, the five words beginning with the M. And you have a passage there at the very end there, which we won't go through there, but this is the Kulārṇava Tantra. But there are five words that in Sanskrit begin with an M. So you have mangsa, meat, and matsya, fish. Madhu or madhya, or which is alcohol. Mudra, which is the one that people are always confused about, because it seems fairly innocuous sort of in that list, which is burnt grains, which are considered highly impure in Dharmashastric text. And then 1, 2, 3, 4. And then maituna, maitunya, which is sexual intercourse. And really, this is the last one. Sexual intercourse is the culmination of all of it. In Hindu thought, the first four are considered aphrodisiacs. And in some form, as well as, you know, being impure and all that. But they're all considered also aphrodisiacs, leading to then this. Now, these texts are very clear, though, that this stage is you have to be fully in control of that. And most texts will argue that the male person has to retain semen within the body in the act, and kind of retain the power within it, and so it's not kind of a free for all sort of a peace and love kind of a scene. But it's highly regulated and highly sort of standardized the way it should be practiced. Because obviously, because there's sexual intercourse that is involved, there's male and female involved as well, and sort of the union of male and female, that's the focus of it. There's the story of Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet, who was gay, who was kind of attracted by a lot of tantric practices, and went to India, and while he was in India, he went to Dharamsala or some place where there was a lot of Tibetans. I think it was Dharamsala. And he was there, and this you find in Buddhist traditions as well. So you have Buddhist tantric traditions like Tibetan Buddhism has these practices as well. And so Allen Ginsberg kind of approaches one of the great teachers of Tibetan tantric, of these sort of Tibetan tantric practices. And he has this burning question for him, and he says, "Can you do it with a man?" and the guy kind of was like, "What?" He's like, "But can you know? Does it have to be male and female?" And he's like, "Of course." He's like, "But can you do it with a man?" He's like, "No." And so it's very much sort of a male and female. That's the whole idea of sort of the union of that. Most of this is practiced in ascetic traditions, and so these are ascetics that will have some form of sexual intercourse in ritual practice, and will consume these things. They will have a sexual partner that is used in the ritual, but apart from that, they live celibate lives apart from the ritual practice.
What about the women involved? Do they also, is that part of their spiritual practice, or are they kind of just like? Like, oh, you.
No. It's part of them as well. Yeah,
you have. Are they also like ascetics or?
It depends on tradition, from tradition to tradition, you do have them as well, and it's a lot of left-hand tantric traditions are kind of, I mean, they're often sort of labeled as Shaiva traditions in some places, but they're actually worshipping goddesses, and they will still, and it's a very complicated thing, some of them will still say, well, we're Shaivas, some will say, well, we're Shaktas, we're worshipping Shakti. But there is a strong emphasis placed on women in some of these traditions as being, you know, sort of important in and of themselves, and not just as, you know, the part you need for the male person who does this ritual. Some ascetic traditions that really take this to the extreme, they will want to have as their sexual partner for their ritual women who are impure themselves. And so it's not uncommon for them to have as their sexual partner a prostitute, for example. And preferably a prostitute of a very low caste, who's sort of impure by all sort of common standards of society, and it's kind of, you get, I mean, these traditions that sort of follow this, they come in various ways. As I said, most of them are ascetics, but most of them come out of cremation ground asceticism, and so it's ascetics that live on cremation grounds and that sort of hang around cremation grounds. And the most extreme form of them, perhaps, are a group that still exists in various places in India and in Nepal, which is the Aghoris, who really take this principle of embracing the impure through your practice to an extreme. They will live on cremation grounds, which themselves are impure. They will only eat things that are found on cremation grounds, so remnants of offerings that are made to dead people and so on. They will only, if they dress in anything, they will only dress in clothes that are found on cremation grounds that are, you know, we were used to dress corpses. They will eat out of a skull, out of a human skull. They will cover themselves with the ash of the cremation grounds. They will, before they eat from their skull, they will offer, you know, before they eat their impure substance, their impure food from their skull, which is impure. They will often offer it to a dog first, who's in Indian culture is kind of considered excessively impure. And it's they will kind of often, you know, for their sexual partner, they will have very impure women. If you have women that are menstruating, which is sort of a period when they're considered impure, that's even better, and so on. And it's kind of just a moment. It's sort of with the Aghoris, they've kind of turned everything upside down in the way that sort of normal society looks at them. And Aghoris are popular because they're considered to have these extraordinary siddhis, these extraordinary powers. They're often, people go to them for healing and so on. But the thing with Aghoris is that they're considered to be to give their blessings through curses, basically. So if an Aghori throws a rock at you, that's a blessing. If an Aghori urinates on you, that's a great blessing. If an Aghori curses you, that's a great blessing. And so it's kind of they're the opposite. You know, they're sort of everything upside down in a way.
Should you put them in the Pashupatas?
Well, the Pashupatas, the big difference is that for the Pashupatas, you know, they're very clear. This is an act that they're performing. For a group like the Aghoris, it's not an act. You know, this is what they're doing. This is a sort of, they're actually engaging in sexual practices, whereas the Pashupatas is, no, you should remain celibate. Don't get allured by women. You know, don't see women as anything other than something that will lead you astray from your path of asceticism. So it's a very fundamental difference in their outlook. I mean, in terms of the popular perception of it, it looks very similar, but in terms of their self-understanding, it is very, very different.
I see. On that point, I was just wondering, it was interesting to note that the Pashupatas are ultimately metaphysically dualists,
yeah,
in a sense, and that there, so ultimately they do recognize at a ritual level the duality between purity and impurity, right? And whereas the Aghoris, etc., they're ultimately ritual non-dualists, and because they're,
yeah.
So I was wondering, do you think there's an intimate relationship or an intrinsic relationship between ritual non-dualism and philosophical non-dualism? Do you think there is?
Yeah.
From what you've studied so far?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Or is that the one undergirds the other,
yeah,
in a sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know of any tradition that engages in these sort of practices that is actually radically, yeah, sort of philosophically dualist in the sense of seeing a difference between the object of their worship and themselves.
Yeah.
And the traditions that are dualist, like Shaiva Siddhanta, or like the Vaishnava tantric traditions in the Pancharatra, they will be all right hand, and they will maintain that distinction between pure and impure, between, you know, sort of the sacred and profane, if you want.
Could one almost say that the function of the ritual non-duality is the realization of,
yeah,
philosophical non-duality?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Ultimately, that's what they're going for. They're non-dual, but they're of a more radical non-dualism than Shankara, for example, because for them, the world is an emanation of Shiva. The world is not an illusion or sort of a mirage or of some sort, but is ontologically real, but is an emanation from Shiva, and therefore is not something that you turn away from, but it's just something that you have to learn to use in the proper way to then come to see that Shiva, which for them, Shiva, because they're radically non-dualist, is not a deity, but it's just pure consciousness, is everything. And so these are not devotional traditions. They're not kind of doing these transgressive practices in the sense of, oh, this will please Shiva, as this is sort of my offering of devotion to Shiva, but it's rather they're engaging in these transgressive practices, as you were saying, to realize the non-duality of it. But it's also, with left-hand tantric traditions, and we've seen this to some extent with Shaiva Siddhanta, though it kind of changes as Shaiva Siddhanta becomes more devotional, but siddhis themselves can be an end in themselves. So the attainment of siddhi, of these powers, is not a bad thing in there, unlike it is for the Pashupatas, where this is a distraction that will come and you have to pass beyond this. For left-hand tantric traditions, liberation and siddhi are two valid options. And there is an understanding that, yes, liberation is in some sense, you know, the ultimate, because you realize the oneness of everything and so on. But they don't look down on siddhis. It is not something that is inappropriate. We've seen this with Shaiva Siddhanta, where, you know, the first initiation you get in Shaiva Siddhanta allows you to attain siddhis. If you want to attain liberation, you have to undergo the Nirvana Diksha. You have to go on a second initiation that will then make you eligible for liberation. Anyway, there's we're running out of time, so there's more that could be said, but that's perhaps a taster of what there is in the wonderful world of transgressive sort of Shaiva practices. But keep in mind that this is predominantly ascetic groups performing this. You do have, I mean, this here, included in this, is what is popularly known as Kashmir Shaivism, which is a tradition that develops in Kashmir, that does have practices for householders as well. But if you're engaging in these things and you're a householder, you keep that to yourself. You don't advertise this. You practice this in secret. And this is kind of a common thing amongst householders that engage in these sort of practices. As they would say in some parts of India, like Bengal, externally to the world, you portray yourself as a Vaishnava, because they're kind of following the rules of purity, and they're kind of following the Vedic tradition in sort of a very, very broad sense. But in private, you're engaged in those practices, and you do that so people will leave you alone, so they won't disrupt your practices. And so you put up a nice exemplary householder sort of facade, and then in private you do whatever you do in your practices. So anyway, that's